serve as an antenna, if you will, a satellite dish, to harness the kaisis, the divine kaisis, and bring them into earth, right? To harness the Shekhinah and bring it into earth. That's in a very broad way. But all the details of the Beis HaMikdash are very, very exact and precise. Each one aims to harness some other kayak, right? And to bring them down into our earth and make it happen on earth. Okay? So when it comes to the throne, Shlomo HaMelech here was using all the different Kabbalistic means of harnessing and channeling all the different forms of Siyata Dishmaya that he would need as a king. And all these different things were built into the throne in different ways. So, number one, it was made out of ivory. Ivory is white. And it was plated with gold. So, Rav Moshe David Ba'al says that here already we are, well, superficially we call it symbolism, but it isn't symbolism. When we're talking here, when we talk, the truth is in general, when we talk symbolism in Yiddishkeit, symbolism is something detached that's representing something that doesn't really have a connection to it, right? But in Yiddishkeit, when we use the word symbolism, it's just a borrowed term. Really, it's something that's actually harnessing the Nimshal. Okay? I'll give you an example. You know why we eat, there's a special Indian to eat fish on Shabbos? Especially at Chalashutz. More so than the other students. If you only have enough fish for one suit, you eat at Chalashutz. The Rambam said, I don't eat at all three suits. But the Arizal, the whole Indian, the Kabbalistic Indian of eating fish on Shabbos at Chalashutz. Why? What's the... Again, symbolism. What's that? Oh, that's the Bi'ar Halacha. Right? Bi'ar Halacha brings the Bi'as, that's the Bi'as of all three suits. But the Kabbalistic Indian of the fish is Judas is going to get to the Bi'as also. But I'm going to use the so-called symbolism. Here I really want to show what symbolism in general means in Yiddishkeit. Symbolism is really a misnomer. Why Shalashudis per se? Shalashudis, you see in the different Sfarim, is really the high point of Shabbos. It's what's called in the Sfarim the Rav of the Rav, the most favorable of favorable times. It's like the peak of Shabbos. That's right. Hill of Bincha, the whole focus is on the surreal future, right? And Shalashudis is kind of in that zone. It's not for no reason that the Hasidim made an especially big deal about Shalashudis and slept it on come up to the Shabbos. Rav de Rav. So the Chaim Vital explains that it's at that point that the Hashgacha of Hashem is at its highest, is at its peak, and this is represented through fish, because fish, their eyes are always open. Their eyes are always open, so that epitomizes the concept of Hashgach. So it's not, here's the point to understand. When you're talking about Arizal, you're not talking, oh, this is a nice way of symbolizing. What that means is that fish is somehow a certain physical manifestation of, that's actually rooted in Hashgach. Fish is a certain physical form of the concept of Hashgach. And by eating fish, you are actually connecting to their Hashgacha in a physical way. That's symbolism. It really takes the whole meaning away, right? Symbolism is really a misnomer. The same idea of the Lidyasa, right? You say that the fish is connected to Lidyasa, the meat is connected to Shabbar. By using things that symbolize it, so it's not just a symbolism, it's an actual live mushel. It's not alive, an inherent mushel. It's the thing itself given a certain physical form. And by connecting to it with this understanding, you're actually connecting to the spirituality behind it. That take that as a cloud. That when you encounter symbolism in the Yiddishkeit, really Yiddishkeit, okay, really Yiddishkeit, when you encounter symbolism in Yiddishkeit, that's the pshat. It's always the pshat is that there is the undercurrent behind it that you're connecting to by you're tapping into it by taking advantage of the physical means. Makes sense? Yeah. Okay. So now. We have the ivory throne. That's a preface to everything we're going to be discussing when we said Shlomo HaMelech's throne was built. There's all kinds of different symbolisms to harness all the different elements of Siyat and Ishmael he would want to do. So we have.
Ivory itself is beautiful.
Why not ivory? The truth is. It is actually brings us that step that Stan is asking. Ivory is a gorgeous substance. Why plate it with gold?
Or if you already plated it, you can use wood.
What's that?
And if you already plated it, you can use wood.
Use wood. Once you are plated, you use wood, right? So this actually brings us closer to understand that it's not just being used because of the aesthetics. It's being used because of the deeper meaning of these things. So Rashi David Bali Tafsir says, he really goes all the way afield with the Kabbalah here. I'm just trying to break off little pieces that we can kind of connect to. First of all, he says how the elephant symbolizes a certain epitome in terms of the Kabbalistic power of animals. Forget about it. I'm going to forget about it. If you want to see it, look there. But ivory is white. White is chesed. The color white is the color of the midah of chesed. Again, don't ask me why. It is. Okay. And, very good. That's mamish inyan in the yoma. It says if your sins will be like red, like red scarlet thread, they'll become white like snow. White is purity. White is chesed. Gold is din. Gold represents din, midas hadin. Again, why?
It's like fire.
Silver is more white.
Yeah.
More like chesed. Gold is more fiery. Ah, interesting. Okay, very good. So Shlomo HaMelech is showing how his malchus runs and how he's operating. It's all solid chesed. But there's a plating of din over it in order to make the chesed work. Right? But underneath, it's really all chesed. The din is just a means of enabling the chesed to work. Okay? Now, sheish malos lakitze. There are six steps leading up to the throne. So again, it's an ivory throne with gold plating. Six steps leading up to the throne. V'roish ogol lakise me'acharot. And the back of the chair was round. Now some understand this to mean that there was actually like this round roof coming up over his head. Others just understand this to mean that it was the back of the chair like you would imagine. The back of the chair is round. Nothing so unique there. Now, and there was an arm on each side. Again, arms of the throne, okay, by the seat. And you had a lion on each of the two armrests. Six steps. Chazal make a big deal about the six steps. And first of all, Chazal start their discussion of Shlomo's throne by saying that Shlomo's throne was built as a reflection of the Kisei Shalmala. He knew how to do that. He knew how to make his throne a reflection of the Kisei Shalmala. Chazal say Kisei Shalmala actually has seven steps. Okay, but that seventh one already, Shlomo, he wasn't going to go up to the top. Okay, fine. Now, what are the six steps about? So Chazal give a whole bunch of different symbolisms that the six steps have. Each one can be studied at length. Six continents. I suppose they weren't counting Australia. I don't know how they counted. Whatever it is. Six continents. The six continents. The 6 days of Bereshit. The six Imahais. This is interesting. Here we count Sarah, Garachaleah, Bila, and Zilpa as the six Imahais.
The six continents scriptures up.
Yeah.
In the Gresham.
Yeah. So then you I don't know which six they would count. I don't know which six they would count.
Did you know about the Americans? Did you know about Australia? I don't know what they do or what they didn't. Properly, I don't know about the Americans.
Ah, that's very interesting. You're also making an interesting point. At that time, the continent of those parents wouldn't even know. Very interesting. Very interesting.
They knew about three.
What's that?
They knew of three of the six.
They knew of three. What did they know?
Asia. They didn't know America, Antarctica, and Australia.
Very interesting. Interesting. Okay. I didn't even cut that. But perhaps most significant for our purposes in terms of connecting to it is the six steps were for Shlaima, the six special admonitions given to a king. Not allowed to have too many wives, too many horses, too much money. Stan just asked, what have we been seeing the whole time here? Okay, we'll have to deal with that. Whatever the case is, Shlaima, in his understanding, was not transgressing those things. And on the contrary, he was making a point of being very conscious of it. The king is the ultimate judge, not to bend justice, not to ever show favor for anybody, not to accept bribery in any way. The king is the ultimate dying. Melech b'nishpat yamid eretz. What's that?
You have to make yourself
an Sefer Torah. Why didn't Chazal count those? I don't know. Chazal don't count those. That's interesting. You're right. I don't know. In the Medrash, they count these three. Meaning, the Lo'isata Mishpat, Lo'isaka Banu Lekishkach Shoykacha. And it says that as he ascended each step, it would actually on a loudspeaker, that admonition would be proclaimed. As you would go up each step, you go up the first step, Layabi Lanyashi. Next step, Layabi Lakezin is off. As you would go up each step.
What happened at the end of the line?
What's that?
What happened at the end of the
line? You truly have to ask you at this point already. Shlaima had his, we're going to see, that this is going to be an intense focus of the coming prophet. Shlaima had his understanding of how he was reconciling it. And on the contrary, we see here that with everything, he's making a point of remaining conscious of it. Right? Okay. Ushnema so aroyim oimdin shah al shay shamalis mizel mizel. And there were 12 lines. Two lines on each step. On each side of the step, there was a line. Lions, the Malbim says, this is invoking the koyach of Yehuda. Yehuda is a lion, right? And 12 of them corresponding, the Malbim says, to three things. First of all, 12 Shvatim, of course. Second of all, corresponding to Shlaima's lineage to Yehuda. It's 12 generations. Or David's lineage to Yaakov. Okay, also 12 generations. Loinasa came to Kol HaMamlochus. There had never been such a phenomenon of such a throne by any of the other kings. Now, just to add a little bit of the added elaboration of Chazal tell us throughout tradition of what they remembered of this throne. It's not all spelled out in the puzzle. So, at the top of the throne, like the form of, it was surrounded by the form of palm tree shaped golden statues, which were bedecked. They were draped with white satin curtains. And each of the lions at the top, each of the lions on the armrest, had pillars coming up from out of their heads. And at the tops of the pillars, it was like vines, golden vines, going across from one side of the pillar to the from one pillar to the other. Now these lions that were at the top, they had, this is very interesting, Chazal, you see all kinds of things that would happen. I'll get back to the lions in a minute, but as he would ascend the steps, he would be helped up by the animals on the steps. He would put his foot out, he didn't actually climb. The animals would extend a lion on one side, an eagle on the other side. A nesher, I shouldn't say an eagle, a nesher, whatever that is. A certain vulture, right. would extend the claw in the wing and lift him to the next step. What's that? Oh, so I was a little confused by that. It doesn't mention the Nisharim here in the puzzle. From what I was gathering in Chazal's description, is that these lions were on the outside of the steps, and then further in, there was another set of animals, lions and eagles, that would actually help him up the steps instead. As he would ascend, they would carry him up. Now, I'm not sure if I'm understanding correctly, but Chazal kind of seems that these were machines, meaning that this was not actually mice and nisim. They use the word in the Medrash a few times is manganoim, which seems to say that these were actually machines. Manganoim, which in modern Hebrew is used like as an engine. What's that?
Mechanism.
Yeah. So it talks a lot about that there was a manganoim that did this and a manganoim that did that. So perhaps not all of this is, there were definitely the Kabbalistic elements in it, but apparently a lot of this was also sophisticated machinery. But, so these would lift him up. When he would get to the top, when he would actually sit down, there were two doves that carried out two different functions. One would, oh, golden doves, would lower down as he sat down to take the Torah that he had to have with him at all times. That would be delivered by the dove. And there was another dove that would lower with its beak, would lower the crown almost onto his head. It was actually hovering over his head. The dove held it in place. Hovering over his head. That was how...
He had to have the same Torah at all times. Why was the dove... He didn't have the same Torah until he got there.
What do you say?
This was the same Torah that he had to sit with.
Maybe just when he went to the bathroom, like the Gemara says. Maybe just when he went to places where he couldn't have it with him. The Gemara talks about that. That Tamid can't be Tamid Mamish.
Well, Shaul was there all day. So he came from the bed to the bathroom, whatever, and he came there.
Right, I would imagine that's a shot. He sat on the throne all day. When he needed to step out, in circumstances that he wasn't going to take the Torah with him, maybe, I don't know.
Maybe this is the basic Nozah.
Echad Munach was the basic Nozah. Echad was on his own. Munach was the basic Nozah. He wouldn't have need for once he's sitting with this one on him. I don't know.
I always thought they weren't like still on another.
So what then?
One was Munach the basic
Nozah,
but one was on
his
own.
Okay. Right, he did. He had it attached to him the whole time. Like Tefillin, like you're saying. But, and therefore, I guess what we have to say here is, like the Gemara says, when he went to the bathroom, he didn't take it. Circumstances, he would take his Tefillin off, I guess. Another interesting thing is, this is just an interesting point that Chazal add also, is that the top lions were hollow and they would spew perfumes. They would spew perfume, such that there was always a cloud of perfume around Shlomo HaMelech's throne. Which is interesting, just when we talk about the effect of the people who came to see Shlomo HaMelech, the association. Right? Not besides all the grandeur, as you approach Shlomo HaMelech, you walk into this cloud of a heavenly smell. Right? All adding to that surreal effect that we already saw, that people were like in absolute awe of Shlomo HaMelech. Okay. Now, we should also add that apparently built into this throne, there were also two thrones on either side of him, two smaller golden thrones on either side of him. There's different discourse in the Medrash. It was either for the Kohen Gadol and the Vice Kohen Gadol. A different nusach in the Medrash is that it was for Nosan Hanavi and Gadol Achoy, the two Nabiim, just to sit on both sides of him on thrones on either side. That's right. It's the other Chazal that say that he had a throne named Perus next to him. He also had an extension of his throne. It seems like it was mamash a part of the throne, where the 70 thrones of the Sanhedrin surrounding him. This is all part of the throne.
That's
interesting. Maybe they made their decisions in one place, but the Beis Medrash was in his throne room. Interesting. What's that? Was there a Lishka Sagotis in the Bais Rishon?
Maybe that was it.
But this is called.
This is in his palace.
The palace was next door to Beit HaMikdash. But that's what. Yeah, I would imagine that. Kodesh means Kodesh. I don't know. But it also could be that. But you see, I had this separate corridor going to the Beit HaMikdash. He had his own. I don't know. Either we'll have to say, like, we didn't say, we'll have to say, like, you're saying there's two different, two different functions. So then, yeah, the Sanhedrin, you had the Beit HaMikdash and you had the court. Okay. Now, when Naso came to call Hamlocha, there had never been such a phenomenon in all of the kingdoms. So, we can take that at face value and say simply physically that no king had such an immense, impressive throne. Because you see, talking in Chazal, that every king who came, they were obsessed with this throne, right? Nebuchadnezzar, he got his problems with it, and then Pari the king got his problems, and Sheshach, Achashverosh wanted to use it too, but he was scared, he already saw what happened to people before him. The Gros says that, he made a hole, that's right, he decided to build himself a replica. This is what happened. I guess this was Persian thinking. Nobody took into account that they're not going to be able to transport it afterwards. Right? They built it in Shushan, which was at the time an undescript town. And suddenly, hey, how are we going to get it there? They tried to get it into the trunk of the car. It didn't go. 70 seats besides the throne, right? So the Gros says that because of that, they moved the capital of the Persian Empire from what used to be Babel, it was Babylonia, Babylon. Was Babel the city of Babel, the empire. They moved the capital over to Shushan where the throne was. They moved the whole capital around it. So, what's that? That's right. So even just on the simple level, it seems that yes, this throne was something that was the subject of the envy of all the kings around. But Moshe David Mali says, look, at the end of the day, it's conceivable that it could be done. You know, it could be done. He says that what the Tosaf is stressing here, that there was never ever such a phenomenon, is talking about his big theme that he keeps getting, the underlying chaos of the throne. How every element of the throne was harnessing some other elements of Siyata Bishmaya, such that the throne was not just a majestic dead throne. It was actually something very live, which was busy harnessing and channeling energies and divinity on a regular basis. Okay, so that's as far as the throne goes.
Why is it allowed to make all these lines and stuff like that?
That is discussed by Tosfos. That's discussed. Tosfos gives two answers, and I'm only remembering the second one. The second answer that Tosfos gives is that perhaps it was made by non-Jews. Just what? It's a problem to have it, even if you didn't make it. But that, since it's done in such a public way, the problem of having it without making it is just chashad. And when it's done in such a public way where you have all Klai Yisrael basically there all the time, there wouldn't be room for chashad. That's the second answer. What's Tosfos' first answer? Tosfos gives a different answer also. I don't remember now what Tosfos says.
So this would answer whenever there is some gold, anything, it doesn't matter, lion, tiger, it doesn't matter what you're making, this would be the answer as well. Adam?
Oh, so I don't know the halakha l'maisa. Halakha l'maisa, I don't know. Okay. The Kofkei Mashka Melech Shloima. Now, all of the drinking utensils of Shloima, the Zohar, were of gold, the Kofkei Desyal, Vanayim, Zohar, and all of the utensils in the summer palace were of Zohar, Sagur, this high quality gold. Ein Keser, there were no silver utensils in Shloima's palace. Why? Like Nefshav, he made the Shlomo of the Uma. Silver had no value in Shlomo's time. It was like, who's going to use silver? No one used silver. כי אני תרשיש למלך ביום אם אני חירה. Because he had his whole fleet of boats, which used to go to Tarshish. Tarshish was a place with very rich with resources. And of course, you argue what that is. Rashi identifies it as Africa, and Abarbanel specifies where in Africa. Something called Kartikna or Kartikna, something in North Africa. What? Carthage. In North Africa, the Malvin takes strong issue with that. What's that?
Tunisia today.
Tunisia?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
It's
a city in Tunisia.
Carthage is in
Tunisia. Ah, okay. So that's how Abarbanel identifies it. Malvin debates that at length. He ends up going much further. He says it's Spain, ancient Spain, which was just about starting to get on the map, not even nearly at that time. But it's an area very rich with resources. And every 3 years there would be a boat coming from Tarshish, carrying with it gold, silver, shinhabim, ivory, the kaifim and monkey, the tukim. Tukim in modern Hebrew is a parrot. Here is that in ancient Hebrew it's a peacock. They had all these exotic animals. By Dala Melech Shlaima, Mikol Malchei HaAretz, Shlaima way exceeded all of the other kings of the land, Va'aisha V'Lachachma, in wealth and in wisdom. Mikol HaAretz Mevachim Esnei Shlaima, from all around the world, they were just trying to get audience with Shlaima. The Shmaya's Chachmosa Hashanosa Nalekim B'Livah. They hear the Chachma that Hashem put in his heart. And from all around the world, kings would come, each bearing gifts, royal gifts, like kesef or pleidav, gold and silver utensils, slomos, veneshek, upsamim. He would have the top quality of all the different commodities, clothing, weapons, spices and herbs, susim or clothing, horses and mules. Varshana Vishana every year would bring his whole yield of these things.
So we should have told him not to bring kesef.
What's that? Not to bring kesef. Right, we see something that didn't have where to store it, yet just had it all out in the streets. Shlomo had a collection of chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots. And 12,000 horsemen. Now this has to be understood, because if you remember earlier we saw astronomical numbers of the stables that he had. And here, we seem to be limiting it much more. 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen. So, the Rambam says here we're talking about the elite of the elite of the elite. These were the choices of the horses that he had collected from the different gifts that he had gotten. These were like the top horses in the world, were these 12,000. Delev Abam Erisrechev, the 1,400 chariots, was his arsenal. This was his arsenal, his weapons arsenal. So, want to get in perspective, you see that Paroi, at the time, he was considered, at the time, he was one of the most powerful armies in the world. It was noted that he had 600 war chariots. I guess we're not talking about regular war chariots, we're just talking about like the top tanks or whatever. And then when the Nabi wants to show you how Sisro was even more powerful, like he had 900 of these war chariots. And they were telling you that Shlomo's arsenal included 1,400 of these chariots. And he had them stationed, some in the special towns that he had for his horses, and some with the king in Yerushalayim. And the king brought it into a situation where the silver in Yerushalayim was like stones in the street. That was how rich things were. And cedar, which was a very high quality premium wood, was as plentiful as shikma. How do they translate shikma? Shikma is a very cheap tree. What's that? Sycamore. It's a kind of very cheap tree that you got forests and forests of it available. The point here is, the Mafar should say, what's being stressed on this pasuk is not that he just made him silver was like stone. This is already showing you what the state of affairs in Yerushalayim in general was. Shlomo HaMelech, with the attraction that he was, with all the different merchants and everything he had coming around Yerushalayim to do business, created a situation where the resident of Yerushalayim, for the populace of Yerushalayim, silver was like stones in the streets, and everybody was using this premium cedar such that it was like as plentiful as the cheapest wood. Okay, we'll stop here. Okay, that's